pregnant women who have long commutes have an increased risk of adverse birth outcomes. We're talking about the new findings here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The study is out of the UW-Madison and Lehigh University, and it suggests that women who travel 50 or more miles each way to work by car may be at a much greater risk. Mothers, do you have a long commute? Did that affect you during your pregnancy? Do you have to do a lot of standing in your job? How have you dealt with that through your trimesters? We're at 800-642-1234. Young Wong is a professor of public affairs at UW-Madison, and her research focuses on health economics. She recently co-authored a study in the journal Economic and Human Biology about the effects of long-distance commutes on pregnant women and infant health. Young, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
What made you set out to study the impact of commuting on pregnant women? Did you have any clues or any data that would imply commuting might have an effect?
According to the most recent census data, about 2.2 million workers in the U.S. travel at least 50 miles each way between their homes and workplace, and about 1.7 million workers spend 90 minutes or more commuting each direction. And as we have all experienced, this kind of long commute can be really demanding physically and mentally. Imagine and think about all the, you know, noise and the bad air and the sitting for a long time, the numbness in the legs and the stress, all that kind of thing. And this can be particularly demanding or hard for pregnant women during pregnancy. So we thought about this problem, and we find it's really unique data, which has information on not only women's home address, but also their employers' address. And we did this first empirical study, meaning using data to provide some evidence on the relationship between commute during pregnancy and the infant's birth outcome. And we actually did find some significant result. We find that for long distance commuters, meaning one-way commute is at least 50 miles, increasing the travel distance during pregnancy by 10 miles is associated with increases in the probability of low birth weight by 0.9 percentage point, which is really big increase. It's also associated with an increase in the probability of intrauterine growth restriction by 0.6 percentage point.
So when you looked at mileage, what was considered a long distance commute? Because you looked at miles, not driving time. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly what we did. It would be great if we have driving time, but the data is limited. We don't really have that information in the data set. So we have to focus on a group of pregnant women for whom we know for sure that they're going to drive for a long time between their home and workplace. That's why we focus on women who drive between 50 miles and 100 miles one way between their homes and workplace. According to the census, U.S. census, if you drive at least 50 miles one way, you're called a long-distance commute. That's their definition. That's why we have the lower cut at 50 miles. And if women drive more than 100 miles, okay, if the distance between home and workplace is more than 100 miles, it's likely that people might work at home. So we're not considering people with a distance longer than 100 miles also. And as you mentioned, if we do have information on travel time, we'll have more accurate measure of the travel time, of course. But now we can only translate the travel distance to travel time.
We're looking at a new study that measures the impact of long commutes on expectant mothers. Young Wong is a professor of public affairs at UW-Madison, and she recently co-authored a study about the effects of long-distance commutes on pregnant women and infant health. You can join in with your questions, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Do you have a long commute, and did that affect you during your pregnancy? Were you stressed during your pregnancy? Did managing work and appointments become challenging? Share your story with us. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Young, how much of these effects, like low birth weight and slow fetal growth, can be connected to the physical impacts of commuting?
That's a good question. So the two mechanisms we actually provide some evidence on are a stress triggered by the long commute and the underutilization of prenatal care. Because of data limitation, we didn't really do much about the actual physical aspect of long commute. So not much there I can say here.
Well, we also know that edema can be such a problem, the swelling hands and ankles and feet during, especially later in the pregnancy. Can sitting behind the wheel have an impact on that?
I think so. I mean, even my personal experience, right, during pregnancy, if you sit for a long time, then you're likely to suffer through bad blood circulation, not enough oxygen, all that kind of things. But for this study, we don't really have any data on that. So the data collection agency, they didn't ask women, did you feel any swell in your hands or extremities during pregnancy? So we cannot really say for sure whether that's exactly what's happening.
So you didn't have those, you know, the physical, you know, the charts, in terms of what those women were facing during their pregnancy in terms of their health. Were there situational or lifestyle challenges that are related to women who have long commutes? Do they get to their appointments?
Oh, that's a good question. That's something we actually explored. We looked at whether for long commute pregnant women, they will also use the prenatal care as often or as early as mothers with shorter commute. And we actually find that maternal long commutes during pregnancy is actually associated with underutilization of prenatal care. That means that for women who are driving at least 50 miles one way between home and work, they receive fewer prenatal care during pregnancy. They also wait a longer period. They wait about 1 week more than other women with shorter commute to have their first prenatal health care. And many of them even wait until the third trimester or never actually during pregnancy to have their first prenatal health care. And we all know that prenatal health care is really important to make sure that the mother and the infant or the fetus are healthy. So this kind of delay is really bad for pregnant women and their infants. And there's a strong statistically significant association between long commute during pregnancy and prenatal care use.
We're looking at the health effects of long car commutes on pregnant women. Young Wong stays with us. She's a public affairs professor at UW-Madison, recently co-authored the study. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Were you stressed during your pregnancy? Did managing work and appointments become challenging? What policies would you like to see enacted to help pregnant women and new mothers? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at long car commutes and the impact it has on pregnant women and infants. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new study out of the UW-Madison has data on the dangers to pregnant women, and it found the longer the commute, the worse the impact. The researchers also think that maternal stress that is made worse by commuting might also be a factor. Looking at the study with your experiences along the way, your insights welcome at 800-642-1234. Expectant moms, how have you dealt with your commute to work? What policies would you like to see enacted to help pregnant women and new mothers? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Young Wong is a professor of public affairs at UW-Madison, and she co-authored this study in the journal Economic and Human Biology. Let's go to the phones now with Darlene joining us from Grafton. Good morning, Darlene.
Good morning.
What's on your mind about this?
I just wanted to ask if any flight attendants were looked at in this study. I do work for a major carrier, and we are allowed to fly through 28 weeks of pregnancy. And in my situation, I did at the time live in Milwaukee, and I commuted to Newark, New Jersey. And my typical work day, which I did four times a month, would be I'd get up at like 6 in the morning, commute to Newark, New Jersey by flying on standby, sit in the airport all day long waiting to then work my international trip. And then on the third day, I would do the reverse. And like I said, a lot of flight attendants do commute to domiciles other than where they live, but they are allowed to fly till 28 weeks. And I was wondering if people like that were looked at, and I can take the answer off the air.
Darlene, very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
So did you work through 28 weeks? What was your
pregnancy? I did.
Yeah. How did that go for you?
Mine was sort of, I think, special circumstances because of my age. I was almost 44 years old by the time I delivered my daughter. The pregnancy went well, except that I did, as soon as I got off work at 28 weeks, within 10 days, I was in the hospital in premature labor, and I did deliver her early. I did deliver her at 30 weeks.
Oh, wow. So you were advanced maternal age, though, but in a situation where certainly, you know, you're sitting and, in an aircraft. Young Wong, what is your response there to the aviation industry and particularly there a flight attendant who is commuting to Newark and then doing an international stint?
Wow, that's such experience. Hi, good morning. So based on this study, we are only looking at women who drive during pregnancy between work and home. We don't have data, the ability to actually look at women who actually travel even longer distance through other transportation mode. But we do know that there's evidence out there that says that it's the missing prenatal care early in the pregnancy or have fewer prenatal care during early pregnancy that has a stronger effect on the mother and infant health. So listening to the story, knowing that you actually have to work the first 28 weeks of the pregnancy, that most likely is related to the birth outcome later. So I think one policy implication from this study is we need to give pregnant women some breaks from early, the beginning part of the pregnancy, either give them paid or even unpaid maternity prenatal leave, or give them flexible working hours, or in some situation just, you know, change their, temporarily at least, their job responsibility so they can have less stress and they can get to their prenatal care on time and as frequently as needed.
How do maternal and paternal policies here in the U.S. compare to policies in other countries?
Oh, very bad. We ranked last almost on all family-friendly policies compared to other high-income industrialized countries. And so basically not very good. The maternity care before and after childbirth and for fathers, almost on all aspects, we're not doing well. So hopefully this study can help policymakers make better policies to cover at least some part of the prenatal care.
And your study looked at women commuting in New Jersey, which has the highest average commute times in the country. Do you know at all what commuting averages are for Wisconsin?
So, New Jersey, we look at New Jersey partially because New Jersey is top three. I think it's not number one.
Okay.
It's top three. And the average travel time during 2011, 2015 is about 31 minutes in New Jersey. And that's also our study period. And for Wisconsin, I just was looking at the data the other day. And for Wisconsin, the average commute time is actually 21.7 minutes, which is not about 10 minutes shorter than New Jersey during our study period. But there is a huge heterogeneity. There's huge variation within Wisconsin. For example, if we look at Dane County, the average commute time is 20.8 minutes, according to this webpage I find. But for some other counties like Burnett, I hope I'm pronouncing correctly.
It's okay. Yeah.
Burnett, Park, they can be as high as 29.1 minutes. That's very close to New Jersey already. So for most people in Wisconsin, I hope, fortunately, it's not a big concern.
Mm-hmm.
But for some women in certain area of Wisconsin where they have to travel long distance, it is actually a critical issue.
Yang Wang, much earlier in the conversation, you broke down the numbers on birth weight and impacts there. Can you walk us through those numbers one more time so we can understand them?
Yeah, so the we find that for women who travel 50 to 100 miles one way between home and workplace, increasing their travel distance by 10 miles is associated with increase in the probability of low birth weight by 0.9 percentage point. So low birth weight here is identified as, let me see, I want to make sure I get the number.
Sure.
I think that's 2,500 grams, yes, which is about 5.5 pounds. And so low birth weight, decrease in probability of having low birth weight by 0.9 percentage point is about, let me check.
we don't have to do the math on air, but Yang Wang, now that you've done this study, and you see the correlation, it's right there in front of you. Where do you go next? What do you study next?
Okay, very good question. So partially more research, partially more policy. So for research side, as I mentioned, we don't really have information on travel time. That's one limitation. And we are not able to say much about women who have a short driving distance between their home and workplace. But sometimes, as we all know, right, a 10 miles distance can take you maybe 5 minutes or 15 minutes, depending on the traffic. So we hope to have some better data or other data that can tell us something about the relationship between travel distance for short commute pregnant mothers and see whether that also pose a threat to the health of their infant or fetus. And on the policy side, we hope this study can raise awareness among people, especially draw attention from policymakers so they can come up with more family-friendly policies to cover the prenatal period. So pregnant women women can either take time off work or have more flexible working hours, or they can work at home, so they don't have to stress too much about having a healthy child, but also make ends meet at the same time.
Well, Young Wang, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Young Wang is a public affairs professor at the UW-Madison, and she co-authored a study that's published in the Economic and Human Biology Journal. It's about the effects of long-distance commute on pregnant women and infant health. Coming up, we look at the barriers to access immigration attorneys here in Wisconsin. That's coming up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at access to immigration attorneys here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For immigrants in detention, finding and paying for a lawyer is difficult, and not having an attorney to handle your case puts you at a disadvantage. Dane County is one of 13 jurisdictions around the country chosen for this new program that aims to give detained immigrants access to an attorney. More than 3,700 people in Wisconsin face deportation. What questions do you have about immigrants detained here in Wisconsin and being considered for deportation? What do you want to know about the attorneys who handle these cases? Join in at 800-642-1234. Natalie Yar is a reporter at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, and she's a graduate student at the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Natalie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So you looked at this immigration data compiled by Syracuse University and found that many immigrants waiting for deportation hearings don't have lawyers. So how often are they unable to find attorneys?
So the biggest thing that I found is that it makes a major difference whether they remain detained until their court proceedings or not. Representation rates are maybe higher than one might expect for people who get released before their court dates. There appear to be a number of reasons for that. But for immigrants who remain detained throughout their court proceedings and go to their final decision while they are still being detained, we saw for Wisconsin immigrants about 9% of those people in the period we looked at from 2010 to 2015, as in people whose cases began between 2010 and 2015, about 9% of them were allowed to stay in the U.S.
And so those who had lawyers were more than six times as likely to be allowed to stay in the country as those without?
Yes, yes. It made a major difference.
Why are so many detained immigrants unable to get lawyers? What does this backlog look like?
Yeah, so two things. One, the backlog that we often hear about in immigration court is actually a backlog just of cases building up in the courts, although there is, if you thought about it in a different way, a backlog of people wishing that they had lawyers and not able to find them as well. We don't tend to hear so much about that backlog, but that exists as well. Why is it hard to get a lawyer? It's hard to get a lawyer if you are detained, one, because there's no right to counsel as far as a right to a lawyer that is provided by the government and at the expense of the government in immigration court. That simply doesn't exist. I like to clarify that some people might listen and think that's because people aren't citizens and the Constitution and those rights apply to citizens only. That's not true as far as what legal scholars say about how we interpret the Constitution. The Constitution applies to people who are in the United States. But it's not because people aren't citizens. It's because immigration court is civil court. And the Sixth Amendment applies to criminal court. So nobody has an automatic right to an attorney in immigration court unless they can pay for that attorney themselves or find a pro bono attorney who can help them.
What about money barriers? How costly is it?
So there are a small number of attorneys who provide services for free. It is very hard to find attorneys who will do that in detention. It's much easier to find an attorney who will take one's case once they're released. That, if you can just imagine what that's like for the attorney can still have that person show up at their office, for example, meet with them as usual, send that person out to go get documents or go meet with somebody else as needed for the case. When an attorney has to serve somebody who's incarcerated, there are various logistical reasons that that's much harder. Those cases also move a lot faster through the courts. We're talking about a few weeks or months that that case needs to be will be decided when the person's detained. If they're released, they move to a whole different court in a whole new time frame, and they might have years to prepare for their hearing.
Are immigrants unable to find lawyers more often in Wisconsin than nationwide? How do we stack up?
No, I don't have rankings on that, but I can tell you that actually the representation numbers in Wisconsin are better than at least some other states and are better than the national average. I would venture a guess that in part the national average is affected by, for example, people detained near borders, people who've recently crossed into the country. I'm guessing, but I don't have enough experience to know for sure, that that's kind of a whole nother ball game as far as what are your chances of finding a lawyer when you're brand new in the country and things like that. Whereas in Wisconsin, we're looking at more people who've been arrested within the community, who do maybe have family members on the outside who could help them, who might know how to navigate the system better. So I'm guessing that that's in part why we differ from the national average. But we also know that efforts have been made here in Wisconsin to improve people's access to attorneys. And I know that there are other states that are showing, similar patterns to Wisconsin as far as having, in Wisconsin, I believe that it's 42% of detained immigrants in the period that we looked at who do in fact have lawyers. There are some states, I'm sorry, who do not have lawyers. And there are any number of other states that do have around half of people able to find lawyers.
We're talking with Natalie Yar. She's a reporter at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, discussing gaps in access to immigration attorneys, with your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. Have you tried getting an attorney to handle your immigration case? What was that process like? Was it hard because of the cost or for another reason? What barriers did you overcome? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Dave now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, ladies. This is such an important issue. I'm a lawyer here in Wisconsin. I'm actually licensed in Illinois as well. And I just believe, obviously, we have to open the border. I mean, this is so ridiculous that we would even have a border, right? But, I mean, how do we make sure that everyone who even wants come to the U.S., no matter where they are, gets legal assistance, free legal assistance immediately? I mean, we need, and also our hourly rates need to be, you know, I have a lot of student loans, and I believe those should be, if I do this work, I want to be paid my full hourly rate, and I want my loans forgiven. But these people need legal representation, free legal representation, until we get the border open. And I'm just wondering, how are we going to get...
Dave, I want to ask you, too, do you do pro bono work right now?
Well, I mean, I guess you could say that. I mean, how do you put it? I do a lot of work that my clients don't pay me, or they also are upset because it was wholly ineffective. But I don't charge for that, so I call that pro bono. And there's no bar exam in Wisconsin, so it's the one state left where you don't have to take the bar if you graduate from Marquette or Madison. So that means I'm in that 40% of us who should never have been licensed anyway.
Dave, thanks. I want to let Natalie in here with your thoughts on this.
Yeah, so as far as the question of providing legal access, I think this is such a... This is kind of the big picture question, right? And the immigration lawyers that I spoke to talk about the idea that, you know, some people might be skeptical or critical of these efforts and might say, why are we, you know, one of the lawyers was saying, you know, people say, you know, why are you giving lawyers to these people? Oh, you're just cheating the system. And they make very clear, like, no, there are immigration laws and there are rules in this country and a whole court system designed to evaluate who should be allowed to stay in the country. We have that system set up. And it turns out that lawyers are the people who know how to make that argument. As we've discussed, there's no right for the government to pay for that lawyer in the U.S., but there's certainly a right to have a lawyer if one can get one. And we know that that obviously makes your case that much more effective. Those of us who have not gone to law school, no matter how educated we are, we wouldn't know how to make that case for ourselves, not to mention if you're dealing with language barriers, unfamiliarity with the system, educational challenges, any of those things, obviously. And some people do fight their cases on their own, and they sometimes get a little bit of legal help from the system, but they have much lower success rates.
Your story about immigration attorneys highlighted this publicly funded program here in Dane County that pays for lawyers to handle these cases for free. Can you tell us a little bit more about that program?
Yeah, so this is one of Dane County was one of 13 jurisdictions selected. They were not all selected at the same time, but Dane County was selected in 2017 to participate in this program called the Safe Cities Network. And that program was going to receive funding from the Vera Institute of Justice to try to replicate a model that was being used in New York City to attempt to provide universal access to attorneys for people in deportation proceedings, or at least in Dane County, it's for people who are detained facing their deportation proceedings, and the lawyers will still continue to work with a person if they get out on bond. But they're looking at that pool of people who are stuck in detention and need attorneys. Dane County was selected as one of these places. They received $100,000 in what was called by the grant catalyst funding, and it had to be matched by local government. So the city and the county both contributed and have since, now that the funding for that the Vera Institute provided will run out in October, but the city and county have both committed funding to keep this going. And they're now working, the Community Immigration Law Center is now working to expand their services. If they can fundraise, they'd like to hire, they're thinking, two more full-time attorneys. They believe if they could hire two more full-time attorneys, they might be able to take on all of the deportation cases in Wisconsin for Dane County residents.
How many do they have now?
How many lawyers? They're employing one lawyer, and then the grant is also paying, or had also been paying, the salary of the person, Aaron Barbado, who runs the UW's Immigrant Justice Project.
So basically two lawyers trying to handle all of this.
Yeah. In fact, they explained to me, like, the grant's intended to provide universal representation, but because it's just not possible, even just for covering Dane County, it's just not possible with two lawyers. That instead, what they do is they go out with some law students and they screen people at the detention facilities here. They go to Dodge County Detention Center, and they screen everybody, and then they randomly select who they can take because they can't accommodate everyone.
Natalie Yar is our guide. She's a reporter at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, looking at gaps in access to immigration attorneys. Join in 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about access to immigration attorneys in Wisconsin. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There's this national pilot program underway that provides free lawyers to immigrants, and Dane County is one of 13 jurisdictions across the country part of this program. There are just two immigration attorneys in Dane County who represent detained clients for free. Meanwhile, the number of immigrants in federal detention has ballooned to an all-time high of about 50,000 people. Are you an attorney or a law enforcement official who handles immigration cases? What do you think people should know about your work or the U.S. immigration system? Call in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism reporter Natalie Yar stays with us, and our new reporting looks at gaps in access to immigration attorneys and what those consequences are. Let's go back to the phones now with Owen joining us from Waiwega. Hi, Owen.
Hi, good morning. thanks for taking the call. Yeah, the thing that I've noticed, and I guess these folks that I'm thinking about that work on dairy farms are employed here and, you know, have been here as residents for quite some time, and then they get caught up in a system and they can be deported. And I don't understand why there's not more help from their employers to try to get them, you know, legal citizenship if they're, you know, they're valuable employees. You would think they'd want to help out the employee to become citizens. So I'll take my question off the air.
Oh, and thanks for the call. Natalie, can you put a face to these people?
Yes. And I would just like to say, I think that's a very interesting question. That's not something I looked into my story. But to me, what's interesting about that question is that we think of, because immigration policy is federal, and because, it, as we know, like our country's climate right now, it kind of feels like all these things are moving in one certain direction. What was so interesting to me in my reporting was to see that certain aspects of this are open to local control for jurisdictions that want to feel differently, that want to pursue a different approach, as far as, for example, giving people access to attorneys. That is something that an employer can perfectly legally do if that was something that was important to them. It's a legal way that one can impact the system if one chose to, or if one had a stake in the system. So I think that's a very interesting question. Putting a face to these people, for example, I followed a family, the family of Eric Gamboa. Eric Gamboa is a late 20s Milwaukee resident, and with a very interesting, you know, it was a pleasure to follow him and his family around. When I first spoke to his wife, Eric was detained. And Eric had actually just won his deportation case. He had won what's called withholding of removal, something like asylum. But he'd been picked up in the September, what folks called the raids, so it's enforcement sweep by immigration, where I believe 83 people across Wisconsin were arrested by immigration enforcement. And he'd been picked up. He had no criminal record in the U.S., but he'd been apprehended at the border when he tried to re-enter the U.S. at age 18 in 2010. And so that meant that he was in ICE's system. And then when he was stopped for driving his boss's car with suspended license plates, he didn't realize that his boss's vehicle had suspended license plates. He was stopped in Waukesha County, got fingerprinted, and presumably that made it easier for ICE to know where he was when they wanted to arrest him in September. The ordeal of him being detained, he was in total detained for about 6 months. Very interesting. He was detained for about half of that time after he'd already won his case. I don't know enough.
Why?
I don't think there's a rule on the government that says exactly how soon they have to release that person after they've won. So his family just knew that there was no guarantee he was immediately getting out afterward. But they at least knew he was getting back out, because the whole time that he was detained, you know, he has three children. His three children, his wife all became depressed. His children didn't want to do the activities they usually enjoyed. His wife told me their 10-year-old had suicidal thoughts. And meanwhile, the logistical challenges, of course, of a stay-at-home mom now having to go out and look for a job, childcare. These are, I think, the things we don't think about when we think about when a person's detained. And one thing I'd like to just differentiate is, like, this is a separate question from whether or not a person still faces deportation proceedings, but the separate challenges that are involved in the person having to be detained while they're in the process. It makes a very large difference in what happens for the person and their family.
We've talked about this cost being a factor in getting an attorney. You also reported that posting bond is an issue. So immigrants are waiting months in jail before their hearings. What is the typical bond amount for immigration cases?
So currently, at least in Wisconsin, most people are not automatically set with a bond amount. So they have to wait and go before a judge for a bond hearing to request it. And in that process, if you have a lawyer, you're more likely to be given the chance to get out on bond and to get a lower bond amount. But these bond amounts can range widely. The data shows that there can be a threefold difference from one immigration court to another. In Wisconsin, the bond amounts... the median bond amount, I believe, is $7,500 in Wisconsin. And If you think about it, I mean, most of you have to pay in cash unless you work with a bond company. And there's been some very interesting reporting about some of these bond companies and the GPS monitoring that they require people to do and the high fees that come with that. So, you know, for most families, these lawyers would say having that kind of money available in cash is quite a challenge. So people are resorting to GoFundMe pages, or they're borrowing money from a whole combination of relatives. In some cases, they're able to get assistance from charitable bond funds. Dane County has one of those that can help some people.
You found that immigrants released during their deportation proceedings are more likely to avoid deportation, but some also never show up for their hearings. Mm-hmm. How often do immigrants not show up after being released?
That's absolutely true. The misconception has been circulated that a majority of people who are released do not show up. That is not true. 41% of people, I believe we looked at the 2017 data put out by the government, and that of people who are released before their hearings, 41% do not show up for their final hearing. And so that is certainly, for anyone trying to promote more people getting released while their cases are pending, that is certainly a challenge that they need to address, is how do you ensure that people show up? So what's interesting is that at least with a certain category of people, the government has tried what they're calling alternatives to detention, which was basically an intensive monitoring system. You can read, if you're interested, this government accountability report that talked about this program and its effectiveness. And they found that for the immigrants who were enrolled in this program, upwards of 90% showed up for their hearings. They had different types of features of this program. The ones enrolled in the more intensive, I believe it was higher than 95%. So it clearly makes a difference what the government does if they release people. And if people are concerned about their show up rates, you know, we do have evidence on things the government has tried before on that front.
Did your reporting leave you with any questions about our nation's immigration system that you want to explore further?
There are certainly a lot of questions about our nation's immigration system. But one thing that I'm hoping to report on more in the future is about this, the side of what's happening when people are trying to pay their bonds. Uh-huh. And what communities are doing, to try to support immigrants in paying their bonds, just how this whole process is working for people. So I'm going to be looking at the bond funds that are being established across the country and how they're working and why they're doing what they're doing.
So there are different types of bond funds going on around the country, you
Yeah,
find?
There are. There, just like folks might have heard that there's a movement in the U.S. to help people pay bail in the criminal system, with the idea that that some people can pay bail and some people can't, and that maybe people in their communities don't believe that that's fair. There are a smaller number of these funds starting for immigrants paying bonds, and I'm very intrigued by how that's working. I've spoke to one person already who runs one of those funds, and I'd like to learn more about how that works and why they decided to do that.
Natalie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Natalie Yar is a reporter at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, a graduate student at the UW-Madison School of Journalism, and her new piece is called Stuck in Detention: For Immigrants Without Lawyers, Justice is Hard to Find. And we have a link to it at WPR.org on the Morning Show page. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.